My guest is Tom Baldwin. Tom Baldwin is a writer and journalist and author of a new biography of the British Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, called, unsurprisingly, Keir Starmer, The Biography. Welcome to the podcast, Hello. Tom. Right. Well, I say biography. I'm told that this could have been originally an autobiography. Can you clarify, please?
I was originally brought in to, euphemistically, help him put it together. And we spent a bit of time doing some interviews and talking about what an autobiography would look like. And it became pretty clear quite early on. He didn't feel comfortable with it.
Right.
He didn't want 300 pages of him talking about how great he was. And that's almost a clue, the first clue, I think, to what kind of politician he is. Most politicians like nothing more than to talk about how great they are. And he is quite buttoned up and shy and doesn't want to be putting himself out there. And so this biography is the result of chiselling quite a lot of stuff out of him, which he is not refusing to put out there, but he felt uncomfortable about getting out. And so I think people who've read it say they've come out with a different impression of him than the one that they had before.
Does that therefore make it somewhere between, sort of a hybrid between an authorised biography and an unauthorised biography?
It's not authorised in that he hasn't had control over it.
Right.
And I, as a matter of fact, know he doesn't like some parts of it and feels uncomfortable with some of it. But it's done with his cooperation. And I think the origins of it as an autobiography are interesting because I think perhaps more than most biographies, it's got quite a lot of interiority. It's got quite a lot of what he's thinking and feeling at various points, because that was the starting point.
Right.
And that was the sort of basis in which we started talking to each other.
It strikes me also that you're very well introduced into Labour Party circles. That's not a secret. But nonetheless, when you started writing this book, were there... And when you started making more, doing more research and talking to more people, and I understand you interviewed about 100 people as well as Keir Starmer himself, how much did you think you knew about the guy before you started, and how much have you learned in the process of writing the book?
I knew him a little bit before. I've been to several meetings with him when I was working on the People's Vote campaign, trying to get a second referendum on Brexit,
right,
and trying to persuade a rather reluctant Keir Starmer to join the campaign. I suppose I had a similar view to him to most people. I didn't realise just how deep some of his emotions go. I didn't realise how ruthless he could be. I didn't realise how decent he can be. I didn't realise he had this vast network of friends. I think he does surprise me.
Right.
I think he's a very, very untypical politician. At one point, I was going to call the book The Unpolitician until I realised it wasn't actually a word. And perhaps you can't actually have a title of a book which isn't a real word.
Well, that comes a lot in the book. It's true, as you say, unpolitician. He's not a typical politician, that's for sure. It's almost like he's doing the job reluctantly, but maybe now he's on the cusp of maybe becoming the next prime minister. He's getting used to the idea. I want to talk about two or three themes which go throughout the book. For example, the relationship with his father. You talked earlier about having to get extract stuff out of Keir Starmer. After a while, he's almost being teased all the time now about referring to the fact his father was a toolmaker. What he never goes on to say until now, and all the interviews around the publication of your book, is the kind of relationship he had with his father. Okay, we know he's a toolmaker, but almost like a tortured relationship he had. Were you aware of that? It's kind of a rather strained relationship. How was it for you to listen to Keir talking about that relationship?
I think I was aware of bits and pieces that he said. The truth is, though, that like most real people, he's complicated.
Right.
And one of the problems with our politics is we try and reduce everything to clean lines,
right,
simplicities, grandiosities, three-word slogans, which I don't think serve us very well. And, you know, his relationship with his dad is immensely complicated. It explains so much about him. You know, his dad was this rather scary figure with a sort of Amish style beard and wore sort of shorts and sandals and all weathers. He was resentful about how people looked down on him. He was a toolmaker, but when you say you're a toolmaker, that means something in Burnley and Blackpool.
That was a craft.
Yeah, I mean that's a really respected trade. It takes 8 years to become a toolmaker. In Oxted, Surrey, it just means you work in a factory.
Right.
And so this is a story about class.
Mm.
It's a story about how there wasn't room for a young Keir Starmer to learn to emote in this rather claustrophobic, tightly bound house where his mum was ill, often close to death, his brother with learning difficulties.
Mm.
So, you know, it's a story about him trying to get out and burst out of there. It's a story about aspiration. And it's a story about guilt because he left his brother and two sisters behind and they've actually had quite precarious lives.
Right.
I mean, there's this very, I think, quite moving bit at the end where, at the end of the first section, where after his dad dies, he's cleaning out the house and he finds at the back of the cupboard hidden a scrapbook his dad had kept, and it has every single moment in Keir Starmer's life neatly laid out, noted, very neat toolmaker's hand, beautifully designed, never shown to anyone.
Right.
He'd never, hardly ever said to his son that he was proud of him. He never said he loved him, but he was so proud, but he kept it a secret. And then, you know, he did some interview with Piers Morgan saying that his dad had only once said he was proud of him. And a woman in a village gets in touch with him and says, "You got your dad so wrong. You're doing him a disservice. You know, I'd go around and see him after your mother died, and he was always watching a Parliament channel," which very few people do,
right,
"just in hope of catching a glimpse of you.
On TV.
But he couldn't say he was proud of his son. He couldn't say he loved him because he was just so tightly bound. And he died, and they never hugged, and they never said goodbye. And, you know, Keir Starmer finds that incredibly upsetting. I've seen his eyes well up, and I've seen him cry about it. And the weird thing about it is he only really found out because he's Labour leader.
Right.
Because someone contacted him because he's doing an interview on national television.
Right.
So he's almost like coming to terms with his rather difficult relationship, extremely difficult relationship with his dad, in the white light of public scrutiny as leader of the opposition at the age of 61. That's quite tough.
It's clear also that his dad was devoted to his wife. Keir's mother was, as you said, extremely ill for most of Keir's childhood and did everything for her. But he was also, from your book anyway, extremely strict father. What I found very striking, a little anecdote from your book, is that Keir says at some point, "One reason I played so much football in recess and, you know, lunch breaks at school was because I hadn't watched TV the night before because Dad basically banned it, and so I couldn't take part in conversation about last night's TV." That's extraordinary.
It's probably been playing Shostakovich very loudly instead. Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary figure, Roddy Starmer. Yeah, I think he's used football as a way to normalise himself throughout his life. He still does. And I think
almost always, too much, people say, like, now he's 61.
Well, I mean, one of his friends, Mark Adams, says, you know, most politicians pretend to like football to appear more normal. Where Keir probably has to tone down the football because it's quite obsessive. But I think that sort of, you know, he didn't tell his friends at school that his mother was ill. He didn't really bring friends home. He wanted always to be seen as more normal than his rather extraordinary, abnormal life at home with his mother, you know, in and out of hospital with tubes in her, and his dad, you know. So I think there is a sense of him always trying to keep these channels to what he sees as real life open, whether it's his old friends,
yes,
football, family. And again, that's not like politics.
No.
Politics is an extraordinary profession, and people tend to hang out with each other and talk about politics. Starmer, you know, everyone has a backstory and an outside life. But for Starmer, without a sort of rigid ideology, I think he derives his values and his sense of self from this real world. And that's why things like football have this outsized importance in his life, because they root him, they earth him.
And how do you explain, or how do they explain to you how he's managed to maintain all these friendships over decades? In fact, you know, he's shot up the hierarchy of the establishment in the United Kingdom and all different careers he's had before becoming leader of the Labour Party. So, but nonetheless, he's kept these links with his friends since school or university.
He says he doesn't trust easily, but when he does, he does.
All right.
And, you know, he has, you know, there's one friend, Colin Peacock, who says he's never lived more than 15 minutes away apart from the time when he was at university. And, you know, Colin Peacock hates politics.
Right.
He can't understand why Keir Starmer went into politics.
Yeah.
He says that when your career ends in failure, as it is bound to do, I will be there for you, saying, "I told you so."
Right.
And, you know, it's just completely separate, that life. And Starmer says he would much rather go to the pub with Colin Peacock than go to any of these receptions, because that's his real mate. Now, maybe that's what politicians say, but I've seen politicians in pubs, and what they do is they walk in, look at me, "Have you recognised me yet?" Usually they go and try and pull a pint for the cameras really badly. Starmer merges into the background with the other middle-aged men better than any politician I've ever seen, because he quite likes going to the pub.
In all the interviews you did to do this book, not just the one you did with Keir Starmer himself, so there were general themes. Was it basically, after a while, you could almost predict the answers to the interviewer's question because everybody's more or less saying the same thing? Or were there occasionally sort of outliers who said, "No, he's not the guy we may think he is, you know, integrity, public service"? Were there any sort of doubters or critics out there?
Well, I did interview some of his critics and some of his enemies in the Labour Party, and some of the people who feel very let down, who, you know, people from the left who worked on his leadership campaign and feel betrayed now. So yeah, that depends on who you speak to. His old friends are pretty unanimous about him, as you might expect, because they remained old friends.
Yeah.
So it's a self-selecting group. Look, you don't go through life without making enemies, and he's very competitive.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got enemies in the law profession, although he's very well regarded there.
He likes to win, right?
He likes to, I mean, in a sort of footballing way, you know, 1-0 to the Arsenal is enough. And he's hard. And people don't see that often, but I think there's this utter ruthlessness and focus in the way he's led the Labour Party, which takes my breath away sometimes.
So when Jeremy Corbyn, the previous leader, stood down and Keir Starmer put his hat in the ring, do you think that was fueled by simple, basic, you know, human ambition, or because he had this sense of public service, he wanted to do something? There was a vacancy. He didn't try and topple, at least not overtly, Corbyn when he was leader, when Corbyn was
leader.
Well,
he did try and topple. I mean, there was a leadership challenge in 2016, the so-called chicken coup, and he backed Owen Smith, who was the rival candidate. He resigned from the front bench to do that. Then he rejoined the front bench, became shadow Brexit secretary, and he served it. Now, there's a lot of debate about that, why he did that. There are a lot of people who refused to serve Jeremy Corbyn. I tell you now, you speak to most of them at the time, they were very grateful that Keir Starmer was shadow Brexit secretary because Brexit mattered.
Right.
It was the issue, and they wanted a grown-up doing it.
So they don't hold him against him that he was in the shadow front bench?
Again, it depends on who you speak to.
Right,
Yeah, I most recognised that that was an important job to be doing at that time, and they'd rather he was doing it than some nutter. He was also planning to run for leadership when a vacancy arose. I describe in the book, there's a thing called the Arlington Group, which was running for at least 18 months before the general election in December 2019. They met every week, and they were planning his leadership campaign. Now, if that had got out at the time, he'd have been sacked. It would have been a scandal.
And what kind of people are in this Arlington Group? Yeah, named after the road in which some of the...
Yeah, Jenny Chapman, who is one of his junior spokespeople on Brexit in the House of Commons at the time. She lived in Arlington Road, Camden.
Right.
And, yeah, they would meet on Monday mornings and have coffee and croissant, whatever you do. And it was his aides, one or two MPs, Steve Reid. And then about 6 months before the general election, this guy Morgan McSweeney joins. Right. That's quite significant. He's now Labour's campaign director and extremely powerful figure in the Labour Party. And he sort of came out of the blue and a lot of people were rather suspicious of him. And then he got his slides out and people, I see what you were talking about. Yeah, he knows his stuff.
Talking to, as you did, at great length, Keir Starmer, do you have any sense that he himself is quite surprised by the speed with which he's managed to, quote-unquote, turn the party around and make it more electable as opposed to waiting several more years in the wilderness?
He seems to be the least surprised of anybody.
Right.
He has, partly because he's not very political, he's always said, Labour's going to win the next election and I'll be able to turn the party around and I'll be able to do this and I'll be able to, and, you know, and everyone would go, well, yeah, of course you're not going to do it. It's a 10-year project, it's a 15-year project. And he's always had a fairly sort of unshakable self-confidence. Now, whether that's misplaced because he doesn't really understand politics, or maybe that lack of understanding of politics has actually helped him cut around corners, which politicians would see as impassable. I don't know. But there is one of the fundamental paradoxes of him is that he has transformed the Labour Party at breathtaking speed.
Mm. The ruthlessness you're talking about.
And at the same, you know, it's been a white knuckle ride, you know, of high risk votes at the party conference, throwing his predecessor out of the party. That's never happened, not since Ramsay MacDonald.
Right.
You know, sacking the person who came second to him in a leadership contest just a few months later.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this was extraordinary what was going on, and yet people still think he's really dull and boring. I mean, it is really odd.
Yeah.
And maybe it's some sort of superpower if you can achieve radical change and be seen as quite dull. Maybe that's the secret for making progress.
As we all know, Labour's been out of power for 14 years now. How well prepared do you think, not just Keir Starmer, but the Labour front bench and the whole, as well as the party machinery at the highest levels, is prepared for the distinct possibility of becoming government in a few months' time?
Partly because nobody thought that Labour was likely to win, even like 2 years ago, maybe even 18 months ago. Those preparations have been late in the making. I sometimes use the phrase of building the plane as they're taking off, almost.
Because Keir Starmer himself didn't think they were...
I think Keir Starmer's always pretty confident, but you know, the people weren't clamouring on board at the moment. You know,
right.
You know, the train's leaving the station, and it's almost like sort of Saigon, people sort of throwing up their kids, you know, please, yeah, you know, like last helicopter, you know, can you have a job in the next Labour government? Yeah, you know, like, you know. And, you know, for quite a long time, the assumption was that, you know, Boris Johnson was his charismatic, right, deeply popular leader, in power for 10 years, yeah, large parts of the...
Unbeatable.
Yeah, I mean, I think the BBC just decided that, you know, he was there for a while and made that assumption. So he hasn't always had the people around him that he needed. I think the focus on policy and transition has come quite late. But the one thing about this lot is they do learn, and they move from 0 to 60 quite fast. And the preparations are very intense now.
Well, pushing this theme a bit about preparation, and you mentioned Morgan McSwinney, the kind of election supremo. I'd have to ask you also about Sue Gray, the former high-level Whitehall civil servant, now his chief of staff. What is your take on the influence she has and how important she is to Keir?
Her job is to prepare Labour for government. Morgan McSweeney's job is to win the election. Those jobs are not entirely discrete in that they overlap. You know, she will be interested in what the campaign is saying, because she doesn't want promises made which are impossible to deliver. Morgan McSweeney will want to make sure that Labour looks ready for power if Labour's going to win the next election. So, you know, there has to be a crossover. You know, what you're seeing at the moment, there's various stories in newspapers being briefed about tensions at the high level between them and or other people. I think those tensions are necessary and inevitable. Some of them are actually quite creative. And, you know, I don't know whether, therefore, I mean, I think it's usually sort of more junior people who trying to impress journalists who do the sort of briefing. But I've been part of a leader of Labour Party's office. I've reported on others. And there's always some sort of tension going around.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the year 1997, which we now think of some sort of Camelot. I mean, I wrote a story when I was working for The Times about how two of Tony Blair's most important aides, Sally Morgan and Angie Hunter, were fighting like rats in a sack. And Alice Campbell made them walk up and down the Bournemouth seafront together for the cameras to prove they got on while they were sort of swearing at each other under their breath. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I don't take them very seriously, these sort of stories.
Well, to finish off, my last theme that I'm going to put to you is, I can't avoid it, Tom, is the European Union relations with the EU post-Brexit, especially since you were involved quite closely with the second vote campaign. Do you understand what seems to be the conventional wisdom that, starting from the top, Keir Starmer himself is loath to get sucked into any kind of serious discussion publicly about future relationship with the EU for fear of giving, you know, hostage to fortune for all his political enemies. Do you understand that, and you agree with it?
My personal view is I'd like him to go further. I am a Remainer. I think there's a danger of Labour sort of fighting the last war rather than the current one. And
why that, you mean the red wall seats, that kind
of
thing?
I think you can overreact to a sort of myth from previous general election that, you know, millions of former coal miners voted Conservative the first time because they hate Labour's position on Brexit. I mean, Boris Johnson won 300,000 more votes than Theresa May and won an 80-seat majority because the opposition was divided. So you can overstate what happened last time. But, you know, quite clearly, Labour does need to win back those red wall seats.
Yeah.
Quite clearly, Labour did have, you know, Brexit was one of the issues which lost them some of those seats in those areas. And quite clearly now, I don't think there's any appetite on the part of the Labour Party or the country to return to those rather fevered Brexit years. What there is a Labour Party which is capable of acting pragmatically in the national interest on Europe in the way that the Conservative Party, which is sinking ever deeper into the swamp of the badlands, the fringes of Conservative Party politics now, cannot.
Right.
And so, you know, there are things that Labour can do, I believe, with Europe, you know, in terms of a veterinary agreement, in terms of visa exemptions, which will show a direction. it's steps. And that's very Keir Starmer.
Right.
Yeah, he is. He defines himself, most politicians define themselves as primarily radical and, if necessary, pragmatic. So the way our cycle of reporting works is it's the rise and fall of a big idea. Starmer is the other way around. Defines himself as pragmatic and then, if necessarily, radical. And so what you don't get is you don't get one big bang announcement. It looks boring. It looks like piecemeal. And then you turn your back and he's halfway up the mountain.
But do you have any sense that, to the extent you have inside track on these things, that once, as and when the Labour Party become the next government, end of the year, if polls can be believed, that they will have sort of ideas up their sleeve that they're reluctant, obviously, to reveal at this stage of the electoral cycle?
Well, what Labour Party or Labour government does is only one half of the equation.
Yeah.
And I'm always aware that, yeah, just as Brexiteers, I don't think ever understood Europe. I don't think Remainers actually understand Europe either.
Right.
I think we think kind of, so Europe is in deep mourning that the UK is no longer there and present at every meeting, and they just would welcome us back with open arms. And it's just, I don't think that's the case. I mean, it's much more difficult than that. And it's going to be a negotiation over lots of small things.
Right.
But lots of small things can add up to a big thing. And I think what you do get is a sense that Labour will be grown up, they'll be pragmatic, they believe in the principle of cooperation with our closest neighbour, which sounds sort of logical, but actually hasn't been followed by this government in recent years. And Britain will be back as a sort of stable, rational, potential partner on a number of different projects. The other factor, of course, is it's not just what happens in Europe or with Britain, there are external factors.
Right.
So if Trump wins in November, then suddenly Labour's talk of a European security pact becomes much, much more important.
Yep.
And so rather than obsessing about the customs union or the singles market, we may actually be talking about how Europe can fight a war against Russia on its own. And so external events, can change politics in quite dramatic ways.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there. Tom Baldwin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.